Good evening, one and all. I know, almost the end of August, but we've been pretty good, and we did have a little bit of rain, but here in Connecticut where I am, but still not bad, not as bad as Europe, for instance. And my guest actually, he's over in Europe at the moment, but it's been a pretty bad over there with the temperature and the fires and the droughts and everything like that going on. But I am here, and so is my guest. Now, you know, you get some people come on the show and their story is unbelievable about their life. And you think, well, why hasn't this been written about, or why hasn't this been made into a film? Well, my guest today, he's done part of that. We'll get to that in a minute. But I better introduce him, because he is he's from the south side of Chicago. He's been entertaining since he's been about six. Italian-American singer-songwriter, award-winning, I might add. Author. Founder of a gene therapy company. He's had five music albums published. Now his second book coming out, well, just come out as well. He's had his own company looking at errant gene therapeutics, which has been going since about 2003, hoping to find cures for sickle cell disease. And unfortunately, his own child suffers from the affliction thalassemia. I hope that's right. Anyway, I better introduce him, haven't I? Because on the show today, I have the one and only Patrick Finley Girondi. Hi, Patrick. How are you doing?
Good evening. Very well. Very well.
And as I said, you're in Italy at the moment, and it's gone midnight there, so I'm sorry I've got you up this late. But
No problem. My pleasure.
So as I said, you know, south side of Chicago, and you were not exactly an easy upbringing. School dropout, and you know, dodging the police half the time and stuff like that. But you were always entertaining from an early age, as I said.
Yeah, I mean, I was entertaining in a number of ways. That's for sure. I was entertaining to some of my nuns and teachers and priests, and entertaining to a lot of my family and friends. But from the south side of Chicago, I think my upbringing was pretty much typical. You know, it was a blue collar area, and I had my run-ins with the police, and you know, I already was enlisted in the military at 16 years old because of some of the altercations.
Mm-hmm. Wow! So they thought the best thing for you was to stick you straight into the services, I guess then.
Yeah, back then they did that a lot. A friend of mine named Frank Murphy, about a week before he got sent up by the same judge, Judge Clarence Bryan, a really wonderful guy. And, you know, I'll never forget, I went and I'm sniffling and trying to put on my show to make sure that I got away again. And he just pushed his glasses up to his forehead and said, "Young man, you've been here one too many times. I want you to bring back, I want you to bring enlistment papers." He looked at his clerk and said, "When will Patrick be back?" And she said, "November 4th, I'm pretty sure it was. And he said, "Patrick, bring enlistment papers November 4th. And I was only 16, and the only military branch in the U.S. that would take me was the Air Force, because they had something called the late enlistment program. Uh-huh. So as long as your parents, one of your parents would sign, you can enlist. And then once you turn 17, you started. So I never finished high school, and I was in the service.
Interesting, because I always say this, it's a bit, you know, people, when I'd sort of applied for jobs and stuff over here, they sort of say, "When do you graduate?" I said, "Well, we didn't graduate in England. You could leave from 15 onwards. You could leave before what was then called the O-levels, which you took like 15, 16. Then you could stay on for another 2 years to do the A levels. There was no such thing as a graduation. People left all sorts of times. Like you can't have the class of the year of such and such, because it wasn't that you all graduated on that year, sort of thing. So it's interesting to know that you could over here, you know, get in the forces at certain times with that, what you said, that thing that the Air Force took. So how long were you actually in the forces for?
19 months. And my mother, who had, you know, five other kids at home younger, I was the oldest of those, that crew, she wrote to the Red Cross asking if I could be sent home. And I got into trouble with my best buddy, Elkin Schatzel. He's my best buddy in the military, and we ended up in a fight in the pool room, in the television room, and kind of got messed up and a lot of damage, and we got arrested the next day. But because I had been having issues with the military all the way from the time I got in, my basic training was supposed to be 6 weeks. It was 11 for me. They said I had an attitude problem. But in the end, the base commander, Colonel Burton, when he saw that I was arrested by the MPs, I had a friend of mine that was working in his office. And he said, isn't that the kid that his mother, you know, the Red Cross said that his mother wants him sent home? And the clerk said, yeah, that's him. That's him. He said, get him on the next flight out of here.
Oh, wow.
So I was really lucky. My friend, Al Quinn Schatzel, he ended up getting an undesirable discharge, unfortunately. But I got a hardship, which is a honorable discharge.
Right.
And, you know, I was just very lucky always. And I ended up going home and driving the truck and loading supplies at the dock.
Right. Because your music, Orphan Dream band is your band.
Yes.
I think it was five or something like that. But I know you've got over 80 published songs. But was it 2004 your first CD came out?
Yes, 2004. We came out with Orphan Soul. All of the CDs are called Orphans. The reason they're called Orphans is because in the United States, rare diseases are called orphan diseases. And my son has thalassemia, which is a very rare disease in the United States, only 1,500 patients in all the United States. And so the first album was Orphan Soul, how I found who I really was, thanks to the orphan diseases. And the second one was Orphan's Journey, then Orphan's Hope, etc.
Right, because along the way, your first book, Diamond in the Rough, that was your first book, wasn't it?
That was my first book.
What was it like? I mean, obviously creating is one thing with music and stuff. I mean, and I know I did like poems to songs, before sort of the book and that. Did you find it a different, totally different way of doing stuff when you did a book?
Yeah, I mean, so I was in the military. Like I said, I was 17 years old. I was really bored. And so I started, just writing my memoir, basically. When I got out of the military, I drove a truck for a while, and then I got lucky. I ended up at the Chicago Board of Options Exchange and the Chicago Board of Trade. I actually socked a guy and got hired because of that. Socked another guy and got hired because of that. It's true stories. Mm. And but before you know it, I was, a rags to riches story on Oprah Winfrey.
I saw that.
I was, Playgirl magazine, one of America's most celebrable bachelors with, Sylvester Stallone and Magic Johnson. And it was just a really wonderful life.
But
still is.
All this time from like 2003, you set the company, Errant Gene Therapeutics, I think that's what it's called.
Yes, which today is called San Rocco Therapeutics. We changed the name this year.
Okay, but the aim was obviously your son, your oldest son, I think it is, had this thalassemia. I hope I'm saying that right.
Yes.
And
yes, you are saying.
Okay, and obviously, the other thing is sickle cell. Now, when people you hear about sickle cell all the time and stuff like that, but as you said, the other one is a very rare. Is there any sort of link between the two?
Yes, they're both genetic defects on the beta globin gene. So when we're born, we have the fetal hemoglobin gene, which is the gamma globin gene, and it turns off when we're about a year and a half old, and the adult hemoglobin gene or the beta globin gene turns on. The problem with sickle cell disease patients and thalassemic patients is they have a defective beta globin gene, so their adult hemoglobin doesn't produce correctly.
Okay, and you're obviously looking into how that can be replaced or be not mended, but I mean, you know,
yes,
how that works. But you haven't, it's not been an easy path for you, has it? You've been like a 5-year court battle or something.
Yeah, in 2000, I met Michel Cetelin from Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York. He was a French researcher who invented the basically how to make the beta globin gene. We licensed that product in 2005. In 2010, we delivered to the world the first batch of commercial gene therapy. And the reason I say it was the first commercial batch is because up until then, people were making a gene therapy one patient at a time at about $1 million a patient.
Wow.
We were able to make enough for 10 patients for $1.3 million or $130,000. Now, of course, I didn't graduate from high school. I don't know much about science, but we have some wonderful researchers and a research team, which is mostly virtual. So right now we're working very heavily with University of Tennessee, University of Southern Illinois, University of Milano, and we worked very heavily with Memorial Sloan Kettering. We produced the product, then, unbeknownst to me, the product got sabotaged.
Oh, well, because you did the big pharmaceuticals, perhaps were getting worried that they were losing money to something a lot less. Could have been.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah, it actually is a huge fund, Third Rock Ventures, which is even actually bigger today than ever. But Third Rock Ventures bought a competitor of mine, a company in France called Bluebird Bio. The company had the product is a defective product. They had problems with leukemia, clonal dominance, etc.
Right.
We've treated three patients on the protocol, have never had any problem, and the first patient treated 10 years ago. But they bought this bad product for $35 million, and it was a really stupid thing to do. And then they called me to buy my product. And I had a meeting with them in Cambridge in June of 2010, and I said, look, I've got a sick child. I'm really interested in getting this to patients, and our product is far safer and more effective. And I'll sell it to you. It's not a problem. I'm sure we can come to some kind of arrangement. I said, however, you have to guarantee that you'll use my product.
Yeah.
And that was actually our death warrant for the most part, because they had already invested heavily in their product. And they went behind my back and sabotaged the product with Memorial Sloan Kettering. And before you know it, I'm having issues with Memorial Sloan Kettering. In 2011, I made a deal with Memorial Sloan Kettering to let them go forward with the product. And before I knew it, they were moving very slowly. Mm. Well, in 2015, I went to the federal court and I said, make them give me my product back, because Bluebird Bio has a horrible product and is actually now in more patients than we're in. And the judge told us that she couldn't force them to give it back because it wasn't in the contract. In 2016, we filed then in court against Sloan Kettering for breach of contract, and we started discovery. They have something called attorney's eyes only orders, which are kind of insane, but basically because there was intellectual property involved, the United States federal courts often, and some of the state courts as well, will say that the plaintiff or the defendant cannot see the evidence. Only the attorneys can see it. And then the attorneys can suggest to the plaintiff or the defendant what they should do. Mm. Well, in 2018, basically, Judge Ostrager said that he was going to allow me to see every single thing. And I had kind of a tough night. It was December 28, 2017, when I started reading the complaint written by our attorneys that wasn't redacted. And basically Bluebird Bio and Third Rock Ventures, they destroyed my product. They stole off of it, tried to fix their jalopy, and just shelved our product and tried to push forward. We settled the court case in 2021, basically. And everything was going fine, until all of a sudden we started having issues getting everything for the product.
Mm.
from Memorial Sloan Kettering. We're back in court, unfortunately. Bluebird Bio just got approved, but for $2.8 million per patient, the most expensive gene therapy in the world.
Right.
Of course, it's crazy because it does cost around $300,000 to make. Mm-hmm. The problem is that Bluebird Bio, which was a $12 billion company in 2018, today is a $350 million company.
Wow.
Their executives stole all the money, which happens in all of these in many of the startup pharma companies. And so now to cover all of the debt that they have, et cetera, they have to charge outlandish prices for their products, which is a real kick in the behind for the American taxpayer, because the American taxpayer pays for most of the development of all the products anyway.
Right. I mean,
and then in the end, they have to pay again through high insurance. And then many people die in the United States because they can't afford their treatments.
And it's amazing. You know, I was sort of looking at stuff recently because I cannot understand how medicines are so expensive in America. And America is the most expensive place for medicine in the world. I think it's like 80% more expensive than, say, Australia, you know, for normal. Stupid, crazy things. My son, when he was young, sprained his knee. And about 10 years ago, $75 for an ACE knee bandage. I mean, you know, seriously? You know,
well, and that's cheap today.
Yeah,
I mean,
know.
The problem is that, you know, the lobbyists, 66% of lobbyists, drug company lobbyists, worked for the government at one time.
Yeah.
And so basically, over the last 10 years, the drug company spent like $4 billion giving bribes to our politicians.
Right.
So the politicians, of course, will never go after them. And you have horrible things like happened with Vioxx and Merck, when 60,000 Americans died because of heart attacks, and Merck had hidden that. And then again, Paxil in 2012, Paxil was going through clinical trials between 1999 and 2007 or 8. They hid, GlaxoSmithKline hid the fact that it was creating suicidal tendencies in adolescents. We lost an estimated 100,000 children who committed suicide after they put them on Paxil. The CEO of that company, GlaxoSmithKline, when they were going through this, name was Jan Leschly.
Yep.
Well, the CEO of the company that sabotaged my product, his name, Nick Leschly, and that's Jan Leschly's son.
I was going to say, I mean, you know, people listening to this thinking, this is an amazing story, all this. And well, it certainly is, because now you have written this in your book, Flight of the Rondon, and came out, May? It's already a number one Wall Street Journal bestseller. You've already got people like the New York Times stating it's must for television and stuff like that. And it goes through this, you're growing up, your high school part, Oprah, and right through to the sort of court cases and what's been going on. Is this something you really wanted to sort of share with everybody, just to, you know, show people that it is possible to sort of get to where you are from where you started?
Yeah. I don't think there's, many things that are as tough to manage and digest as having a child, your own child, that has a sickness.
Mm.
And it was my dream that parents would suffer less. I remember the years of, when my son was diagnosed in 1992, they basically told us he wouldn't make it to be 14 years of age. Thank goodness today he's 32. He still transfuses every 20 days, but he lives a very normal and full life. And so I wrote the book kind of hoping to let people say, look, if an idiot like me, who never even graduated from high school and who's kind of all over the place, can do this, you can also do this, and you could probably do it better. And in the end, by the time I was done, and by the time I finished the book, which was in roughly in 2021, I was so upset and disappointed. I think that's the best word. I was so disappointed by the behavior of very few people, which cost the lives of many people. I mean,
right.
You know, these people cost more lives than Adolf Hitler cost.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, the Sackler family with the OxyContin.
Yes. Yeah. Just lost it. Okay, looks like I just lost my guess. I'm just going to try and give them a call back. I know the signal's been going a bit, so let's just try and call him back. Looks like I have. Okay, let's try and see what we can do. We're having a bit of trouble here. Oh dear. Okay, we've only got a few minutes left. I'll carry on. See if I can get him. I'll just try once more. Let's try it once more, eh? See, these should have to be these live shows, doesn't it, of course? Hello, Patrick.
Hey, Barry.
Yeah, sorry about that. Got line dropped there for whatever reason. Never mind.
Yeah.
You were saying about the people that do the Oxy and all this sort of
stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, the Sackler family with OxyContin, we have a million Americans lost their lives, overdoses from OxyContin,
yeah.
And they purposely did this. So in the end, the Sackler family has made in the pharma industry about $14 billion. And they're making a deal with the government to pay $4.5 billion, which is $4,500 for every murder that they committed.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
a friend of mine, actually.
It, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I mean, you know, when she's, yeah, and it's like you said before, I mean, how is it that things have gone so crazy in the United States of America? I have no idea. It's crazy. And I actually have a guy I became friendly with named Eugene McCarthy. He's a professor, I believe, right now at John Madison. And he wrote a wonderful article about 3 years ago, which says that the U.S. government should use RICO against the pharmaceutical industry. And when you look at the scandals and how these people, you know, I have a one of my book trailers. I talk about John Gotti, that it was estimated he made $10 million a year at the best time of his life. And that, you know, the mafia was responsible for 200 murders per year.
Mm.
Well,
it's nothing.
The pharma
industry, nothing compared
in the United
to pharmacists.
States, zero, zero, zero. And, you know, white collar criminals, and they kind of, you know, they murder our children and our loved ones, and then they go to dinner and golfing the day after. I mean,
exactly.
It's just, it's insanity. They're just cowards. And very often it's hard for me to sleep at night because I'm a Catholic and I try to be a good guy and I'm a Franciscan. When I was a kid, I went to the seminary. I lived with 62 priests and brothers. There was 83 students. It was a wonderful time. And I try to be a good person. I try to be a good Catholic. And from time to time, it's hard to do, knowing that these people are continuing to do it with impunity.
Yep.
They're protected from the United States of a government. They're protected by our politicians, and they're murdering people as sure as me and you are speaking on this telephone.
Indeed. Well, I'm hoping that, you know, obviously the book has terrific response from the book already. And I must agree with New York Times that it's definitely meant for television. And I can see, hopefully, if it gets on television, the word's going to get out there and you can just, you know, but hope that, you know, something's done about it. Because as you say, it's, you know, they do get fined, but it's not even a slap on the wrist half the time.
Right. They get fined, but none of them get fined personally.
No.
So, you know, it's like, oh, what's his name? Gil Martin, I think it was. So the CEO of Merck, they got fined $950 million for the Vioxx scandal. Mm-hmm. And he made $14 million that year, his last year, $14 million.
Yeah.
He never got, you know. So the company, they're protected by the corporate shield.
Yep.
And the taxpayer ends up in the long run. First the shareholder.
Yep.
But, you know, ends up paying the fines. So, I mean, they're really, it's crazy. Really, really crazy.
Well, as I say, let's hope, you know, the words, the book might, hopefully, you never know, do something. But what I'm going to do now, anyway, is actually hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where people can find out more about you and your books and your music and everything else like that. So over to you, Patrick.
Thank you. So Flight of the Rondone. Is published by Skyhorse Publishing. It can be purchased audiobook, Kindle, etc., on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, BAM, Walmart, Target. And you could also get it through my own website, which is patgirondi.com. My music, same thing, Apple, Spotify, Amazon, iTunes, you can get my music. And I appreciate this time, Barry.
Thank you so much. And, you know, I really hope all success to you. And perhaps one day, you know, these illnesses will be cured for a lot less and a lot less people make money on them. So thank you anyway for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much, Barry.
There you go. My guest today, Patrick Girondi, G-I-R-O-N-D-I. And we've been talking about his life, his books, his music, and everything else that he's done, including his new book, Flight of the Rondone, R-O-N-D-O-N-E, R-O-N-D-O-N-E, which is, as I said, already number one Wall Street Journal bestseller. Great stuff. And as you've heard, you know, there's so much interesting stuff in it, so much that Patrick's done, been through, and, you know, created and done for everybody, and still fighting for us, still fighting for people, for children, for people who are, you know, not as good as some of the rest of us. Anyway, that's great. Anyway, I'll be back tomorrow with a fresh guest. But until then, as always, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget.